and got me started. Sold me my first hen. Now I got 4 and 20 and 24 more again. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? Chicken in the morning, it's chicken in the night. Weren't for chicken, Petaluma never would have reached its height. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, smart talk about food, wine, and farming. Yes, indeed, it is Michelle Anna Jordan, live and in the flesh. Mike, we just took 3 weeks off, right?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, we took 3 weeks off. It feels like so much longer. I was on the way to the station last week when our scheduled guest telephoned, and he was stuck in San Francisco. A conference where he was speaking ran long, so he wasn't able to be here. But that's why it extended to a 3 week absence rather than just 2 weeks. Anyway, hope you had a good start to the new year. But remember, if you didn't, if maybe you had a hangover, or maybe you had that flu that was going around and you didn't have a great start to the new year, you've got Lunar New Year coming up. So you have a second chance. I think it starts this year. It either starts on February 6th or February 8th. And it's a great celebration, and there's not a lot of advertisements telling you you have to go out shopping. So I love Lunar New Year. A couple of things. If you like to listen to Mouthful by podcast, it seems there's been a problem the last couple of months. We archive the show automatically now, and when daylight savings changed, we didn't. So we have a few shows that are lost to the ether, but we will get that straightened out with this show, and we'll be back up with our podcasts as they should be. Tonight's guest is someone that I just truly adore and admire. And it was through her produce and her ability to grow food, not only that tastes really good, but that no one else was growing, but a lot of people were wanting. Back a while ago, I think it was around 2006 or 7 maybe, but we'll find out for sure, under the name of Crescent Moon Farm. And I remember the first time I saw Padron chilies. They are ubiquitous in Sonoma County now. They're on every restaurant menu, probably throughout America. But at that point, unless you were paying attention, you didn't realize it was impossible to get padrones. Pretty much had to go to Spain if you wanted them. And then Jill Adams came along, and she gave us padrones. And you had to get there really early because at first there weren't many. I believe she followed with shishitos, was the person who introduced us to shishitos. I didn't even know about them. And also began growing something that looked like a red porcelain sculpture from Mars. It was red okra. It was so gorgeous. And then followed up that season, towards the end of that season, made the best chipotle powder ever, and then moved away. And now she has moved back. I sort of summed up the last decade of your life really quickly, Jill. But from my vantage point, that's sort of how it was. So welcome to Mouthful, and welcome back to Sonoma County, which I hope is your rightful home.
Thank you so much.
So what you are doing now, let's start with what you're doing now and then sort of go backwards a little bit because you're at the farmer's market again.
Yes. Yes. I'm selling wild mushrooms under the name of Oyster Creek Mushroom Company. And they're all wild mushrooms harvested in Mendocino County primarily. Mm-hmm. And I started in wild mushrooms when I was living in Maine for the past 4 years. And I was working for Oyster Creek Mushroom Company out there, started mm-hmm. by Candace Hayden. And I don't know where to go from here, but we actually met in Sonoma County. There were two winters when she came out.
I remember her. Yes. I remember getting, she had my favorite. She had hedgehogs.
Oh, yeah.
And they were so good.
Yeah. Definitely very good and tasty. So when I was selling at the markets here in Sonoma County, she came out. And I have family in Maine, and I would always just go around to see new faces, you know, who's selling what at the market. Just I was curious and mm-hmm. interested. And so I introduced myself to these two women. And it's like, oh, you know, wild mushrooms, how interesting. And she started talking. And I was like, where are you from? Her accent was so Maine. And I have family in Maine. It's just a very unique accent. Like, you know, yes. that accent if you hear it. And so I was like, where are you from? So she's like, oh, from Maine. And it turns out we both have family roots in Solon, Maine, which is this tiny little town along the Kennebec River. And so we instantly just thought, like, well, we must be related. And of course, we, you know, we just love each other, good friends. And mm-hmm. So when I moved out to Maine, I started working for her out there as well. And that's where I really started to learn about wild mushrooms. So I've been interested before, but I didn't really know anything about
them. Were you foraging?
I was. I started... Yeah, one of the first times we spent time together, she and I, once I moved out there, she took me to a couple of her chanterelle spots. And, you know, all summer long, I kept seeing mushrooms thinking, like, oh, I bet that's a chanterelle, but I'm not sure. And there was never a chanterelle until I finally did really find one. And then I was like, oh, this is definitely one, you know. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it was like, the more you're around the mushrooms, you know what is and what isn't. And, mm-hmm, and I've yeah. read up on things and studied. And mm-hmm.
So does her company, she comes here to Mendocino County?
She used to. She okay. did those two winters, and she hasn't ever since. Mm-hmm. I think it was part of an unhappy marital situation. Ah. It was a reason to get out. And she has family out here as well. Mm-hmm. And so it was just convenient. And but no, so now I'm out here okay. doing this.
Oh.
And
so are you going for, do you forage?
I do go out foraging. Most of the mushrooms that I'm selling, I do get from other pickers.
Oh, okay.
There's like a network of pickers yeah. up in the Mendocino area. Uh-huh. And so I did go out last week, and the person I buy from, he took me out to some of his spots and on public land up there, and it was really just fun, sweet, really sweet to get back out. Mm-hmm.
So this was in January. What were you finding?
We were finding some chanterelles, golden chanterelles. Mm-hmm. We found some, what do they call, pig's ears, I think is what they call it. And it's this huge, really unique-looking chanterelle. I'd never heard of it or seen it before, and we found it. And beautiful, huge, and then dark, really dark on the underside. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. He kept that. And then we found a couple black trumpets, but they were just starting, and we weren't finding
them. Are
they
just starting now?
They're just starting.
I love black mushroom, yes. black yeah. trumpets.
Me too. They're one of my favorites. And we found some yellow-footed chanterelles, some candy caps, and some hedgehogs.
Some hedgehogs.
Yes. Yeah, and the hedgehogs are just starting as well, so
oh, great.
They will be
now, hedgehog, there's one, the maitake. Mm-hmm. Is that hedgehog? Or yeah. is that, that's hen of the woods?
Hen of the woods and maitake are the same.
Okay.
Yes.
So, and does hedgehog have another name?
Probably. Sweet tooth.
Oh, okay.
Is one. And then, of course, the scientific name, which I can't think of right
okay.
now.
Because I also love the maitake, the hen
yes.
of the woods. I love
Me
those.
Too. Yep. Very good and very tasty.
Yeah. No, are all the mushrooms that you're getting, mm-hmm. You can't cultivate chanterelles, right?
Correct. You cannot. Yeah. As far as I know, you cannot cultivate chanterelles or black trumpets or porcini, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Morels, which will come in the spring. I think people people sell the spore, but it's really hit yeah. or miss, and most likely you're not going to succeed. And as far as I know, mm-hmm. somebody might call in and be like, no, that's so wrong. I don't know.
Now, do you think we'll have a lot of morels this spring in Lake County because of the fire?
I was wondering that too, and I don't know.
Because that's what they say, right?
Yes, a fire.
Yeah, a fire line.
Mm-hmm, and I think part of that is they like a more alkaline soil, and so fire increases the pH.
Okay.
And so then if there are mushroom morel organisms in the soil, then mm-hmm. it'll inspire them to bloom or mm-hmm. fruit, I should really say. But Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I was asking my Mendocino connection about that, and he was saying that I forget what tree they're commonly associated with too, but that wasn't necessarily prevalent in Lake County. So I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. And mushrooms, if I'm right, they have relationships with trees, right?
Some do.
Some.
Yes.
Like I think if I remember right, and you can call if I'm wrong, because I'm not a mushroom expert, except when it comes to cooking. Shaggy manes, I think, have a relationship with the big oak trees. I guess that's the live oak.
Okay, possibly.
So what I've heard is that's where you look for oak trees, is underneath the canopy of a big oak tree.
Cool. Yeah, and I'm less familiar with shaggy manes. There's some that I'm familiar with, and you know, and parts that I'm very familiar with, and other parts about the mushrooms that I just don't.
Well, and shaggy mane, you don't see them commercially,
right? Right.
They eat themselves.
Right. Yeah. You were saying that the other day.
Yeah. They're one of the ones that auto digest. As soon as the fruit pops up, they start auto digesting. So you have to be really lucky. Spot them as you're driving by. Pick them and come home and cook them.
Yeah.
That's it, because they don't keep it all.
Yeah. Kind of like picking an ear of corn. They say
get
water boiling and then go out to the field, grab the corn and come right back in. That's the best corn.
Yeah. And then where I live, in certain years, a little white mushroom comes up. You can almost see through it. It looks like a little fairy umbrella. And the minute it comes up, it starts auto-digesting.
Oh, wow.
And so like at the end of the cap where like if there was fringe, if there would be fringe there, it just starts turning black and inky.
Wow.
And you go out a few years later and it's gone.
Yeah.
I have no idea what they are.
Oh, I don't know. So many. There's so much diversity in mushroom kingdom.
Yeah. So what else do you have? So we talked about chanterelles. What else do you see? Are you selling right now?
For the wilds, chanterelles, yellow-footed chanterelles, also called yellow feet or winter chanterelle. And then black trumpets, which are also called black chanterelles. And then hedgehogs. But then I also have some dried mushroom as well. So dried morel, dried porcini. I make a dried California wild mix, which has all of those that I just mentioned, plus the morel and whatever else, porcini in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you'll be doing that, what, through April? Is that the season?
Morels and porcini come through May, but depending on the season, they come back out.
They do. Okay, because I always think of them as fall.
As fall, right? But then they take a hiatus, and then there's a spring fruiting up in the Shasta area primarily.
Oh, okay.
As far as I know, I'm sure other places too.
And what do you need to know to not kill us?
to not kill us?
Yeah. what are the signals when you're out there foraging? What are the signals that the mushroom gives you that you shouldn't mess with it? I know one of them has a bright red, you know, it has the amanitas, which is bright red and the little dots
the white
on it.
Spots. Yeah. I mean, really, there's definitely far more edible mushrooms out there than I pick. But that's the thing. It's like you just have to know your limitations.
Yeah.
Like know what you know and know what you don't know, and then don't go into the gray area of like, I think this is right.
Yeah,
you know,
you never use those. That
yeah. So it's I read somewhere once. There are old mushroom hunters and there are bold mushroom hunters, and there are not old and bold mushroom hunters.
Yes,
yeah. So you just don't. Yeah,
you want to. Yeah, never say I think it's okay. Go ahead.
Right, right. You don't. You just don't want to mess around. So I mean, there are just ones that I feel very confident picking, and then there's ones that like I just won't.
Yeah,
I might look at the book, and maybe I'll take it home. But whenever I go out foraging, if I have any questions about any mushrooms, I don't put it in with any other known edibles. Like
sure.
I just keep it separate. You just don't want to mess around with that. You know, you just don't even cross that line.
Yeah,
why take the risk? You know. So
it's one of the reasons I've never gone foraging myself, because I just don't feel like what sort of confidence do I really have.
Sure. But there's so many fun ones. So the hedgehog you mentioned earlier that you really like that. That's one of the easiest mushrooms to identify. And there's really no deadly lookalikes. And they're a toothed mushroom. On the underside, so on the underside of the mushrooms, we always picture the standard mushroom with like the very fine, paper thin gills, and like chanterelles don't really have those. They have more like ridges where their gills are, and they're bisected and they look different. And they come partly onto the stem. Yeah, you can take a look at those.
Here we have a nice. This is a good size yellow chanterelle.
Yeah,
the gills are a little bit thicker, and they extend down to the first quarter of the stem.
Yep. And then if you look really closely, they're branching as well. and they don't, they're not just fine parallel gills like the shiitake or the portobellas or a lot of those gilled mushrooms, but then the hedgehog, they're toothed. And so instead of gills, they have just these fine little like hair, these teeth.
Yeah, I think I've seen pictures of them. Oh, there we go. Okay, I was thinking of a different one. We've got a great, you know, if you have your computer nearby, you can just go to Google and Google hedgehog mushrooms and hit images.
And they're so unique looking that you really can't mistake them for anything else. And there is a poisonous relative, but it looks absolutely nothing like that. It's called like bloody or bleeding something or other. It's just hideous. Like, you wouldn't even look at it and say, ooh, that looks good, I want to eat that. It's like spotted red and white and just looks horrible. But then it has teeth on the underside. There's really, hedgehogs are just sort of a real nice introduction to mushroom hunting. And black trumpets, too. Those are pretty easy
black
as well.
And black trumpet doesn't have a look-alike evil twin.
Right. Although there's some, I've taken some friends out, and if you see, like, a dead, decomposing mushroom of some other kind, it's possible. It doesn't seem right to say or to think, you can't imagine, but, like, it's possible for somebody to mistake that. Like, in the eagerness of wanting to find a black trumpet, they see this black, slimy thing that, like, it might be a little concave or something. And then they're like, oh, I think I found a black trumpet. Yeah. They'll bring it to me, like, this slimy mess. Like, is this a black trumpet? No, it's a dead, nasty mushroom.
Yeah. Black trumpets are definitely not slimy.
No, not at all.
I know. Pasta with black trumpets and cream,
yes,
or risotto with black trumpets, both. God, I love both.
Or pork chops. I really love black trumpets and pork together. Yeah, they just go so well.
I've never done that.
So delicious. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, and a cast iron skillet with some butter and garlic and potatoes and just sort of roast it all together. It's like, it's amazing.
Okay.
And I'm no chef, so I don't know. You might think like, wow, that sounds gross. But
no, it sounds really good. Delicious. It sounds really good. And on that note, we're going to take a little break here on Mouthful.
Sugar cane time, all along about you. I'll be walking with sugar in the old sugar moon. Gonna drop her a line to say expect me soon. Hey, I'm craving some sugar neath the old sugar moon. I can see her right now. She gets the calendar down. Circle around the day we're all to bound. When it's sugar cane time, all along about you, wedding bells will be chiming beneath the old sugar moon. Sugarcane time, all along about you, I'll be walking with sugar near the old sugar moon.
Music from Sonoma County's own Kevin Russell. Before we leave the topic of mushrooms and my guest, Jill Adams, we're going to find out about, well, we're going to find out a number of things, but before we leave the mushrooms, there is a website, oystercreekmushroom.com. This is Candace's website.
Yes.
And tell us more about it. Looks like there's recipes on the website.
Yeah, she's got recipes on the website. She also sells a number of dried products. So a lot of dried mushrooms, some that I don't have available at the market. Mm-hmm. And then like candy cap oil.
Really?
And of course, candy caps are only found out west. And
candy cap oil. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so she buys dehydrated candy caps from Mendocino Mushroom Company. And he ships them out to her, and then she makes, she simmers them in, I think, is it canola oil I think she uses? She might have switched to a different oil because of the whole GMO free
thing. I hope so, because
yes.
Canola's like,
not
no, we
amazing.
Don't like canola.
Yeah, yeah. So I think she may have switched to like sunflower or safflower, I'm not sure, but, and she steeps the candy caps in this oil for, I don't know, half the day or something. Mm-hmm. And then it's this really beautiful, light, like maple-y. I meant to bring candy caps and I must have left them. I was going to have you smell them. But they smell like maple syrup or something, like
yeah.
a sweetness. They lend themselves to like a sweet dish. So, and then she also makes a vinaigrette out of the candy cap oil and mm-hmm. some herbs and she sells that. And then porcini oil, she makes that.
Mm-hmm.
Out of dried porcini, but mm-hmm. And what else? Oh, and she also sells mushroom plugs. So if you want to grow your own shiitake mushrooms or oyster mushrooms, she sells plug spawn for that.
Plugs?
Yes. So, yeah, so it's like they're like little dowels that have been inoculated with the mushroom spawn. I'm not sure which the right word is.
Spore.
But, yeah, spore. Okay. And then that becomes the spawn. And then you hammer that into... First, you find like a 3-foot log living. You cut down a living tree because it has to be living. If it's dead, then other organisms have already moved in and are starting to colonize that log. So your mushroom has a disadvantage. So you want to cut down a live tree and let it maybe sit for a couple weeks so that any kind of like antifungal properties that the tree might have mm-hmm. Dissipates. Goes away, is no longer active, and then drill holes in a diamond-shaped pattern around the log, and then you hammer these dowels in, seal it over with a beeswax or a paraffin or something, and then you stack them and let them sit for a year, and then possibly oysters. Oysters are such vigorous growers that mm-hmm. they might produce. Like if you do it in the spring or here in California, I guess you could do it now, and mm-hmm. then maybe by the fall they'll produce because mm-hmm. they're pretty quick. But shiitake will take like a full year.
Mm-hmm.
So it says on the website that shiitake you want fresh cut oak, and oyster you want fresh cut poplar, maple, or cottonwood.
Yes, yes.
Interesting. And you know there've been various people over the years that sell. Things.
Yes.
globs of
yes.
wood chips and
sawdust
soil and all kinds of stuff to mm-hmm. grow my, you know, I sent when Nicole, who loves to cook and loves good food, when she was going to school in, I think it was when she was in Providence, Rhode Island, I sent her a mushroom log and
yes.
she got 3 or 4 fruitings from it.
That's great. Do you remember what kind it was?
I'm pretty sure it was shiitake.
Yes.
It might have been oyster, but I think it was shiitake.
Fun. Oh,
yeah.
That's fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So check out that website.
Oyster
Hammer
Creek
the dowel in a diamond pattern.
Yeah.
That's probably why I'm not a gardener. the precision and the drilling holes and stuff. That sort of
you could do it in any pattern, really. But I think it's just for efficiency.
Uh-huh. Have you done it?
I have. Yes. Yeah. So my ex and I in Maine, we cut down. An oak, and we inoculated about 15 logs or so, and yeah, and then the following year they produced, and
how cool,
yeah, they were, and they're beautiful, they're just lovely, really uh-huh. beautiful, like almost all like a dark brown on the top. There's all sorts of different strains. You know, there's some strains of shiitake that grow better in colder weather, and then there's some that grow and are different, you know, different color, different shades of whatever brown. But yeah,
cool.
That was fun.
Okay, so I didn't get to know you because of mushrooms, though. Before we leave that, you had that wine cap or something?
Yes.
Tell me about that. Are you going to like revive that?
I would like to.
And you should you should describe it for people. It was really beautiful.
Sure. It's a guild mushroom, and it's a really easy mushroom to grow. It was amazing to me. So that year, we built the boxes in July, like early July, and we spread the spawn out. And by September, we were having like huge flushes of mushrooms. I could not believe how quickly they grew. But it's called a wine cap mushroom or King Strepharia. And it's a mushroom that you can, once you get colonized in an area, then the following year, you can take shovelfuls of it and mulch different parts of your garden or your perennial crops or your fruit trees or wherever, and raspberries. And then with the right conditions, and I haven't tried this, so I can't speak too much from experience. I just know people do it. Then they'll just grow in your garden, and you'll just get mushrooms whenever the conditions are right and whenever they want to do it.
And what is it that they want to grow in?
So what we did was we got different sized hardwood chips. So I can't even remember where we got them from, but you can sometimes find tree cutters.
Sure.
But oftentimes there's a lot of softwood mixed in, which is probably okay, but you want primarily hardwood. And then we mixed in compost and maybe even some sawdust because it likes like the different sizes of material. It's just more for that organism to kind of feed off of and at maybe different stages or something. I'm not sure exactly why, but and then we mix that together, the wood chips and the compost, maybe 3 or 4 inches deep, I can't remember, but and then we spread the spawn that we got from Field and Forest, their company, mushroom company out of Wisconsin. And so fieldandforest.com, and we bought the spawn from them. They mailed it to us. We spread it out on the top of this mixture, and then we spread a little bit more of that mixture on top of the spawn and then covered it in straw and then set up just a little sprinkler irrigation system on timer and just had to go for maybe like 20 minutes twice a day. Because it was, like I said, it was in July in Santa Rosa, and it was
hot. Yeah.
And we did this in the shade, like dappled sun, mostly shade, shade.
But this is when you had Crescent Moon Farm.
Yes, that's when I had Crescent Moon Farm. Yeah. Yes.
And where did the name come from? I've always wondered, just because I like it.
So you probably remember David.
Yes,
David Mooring and I started the farm together. And we met when I was working on a farm in Sebastopol called Easy Sweet Farm. Neil Dunitz was running that farm, and I was interning with him through the WOOF program, Willing Workers on Organic Farms. And so when David and I met, the first hike we went on was under the crescent moon. And so when we were trying to come up with farm names, that was one of them. And we quickly dismissed it because it, I don't know, it just didn't sound right or didn't roll off the tongue. But and there were beautiful, well, oh my gosh, the bird is totally escaping me. We're both into birds, and there was this one little bird. I'm totally, Black Phoebe, my gosh. And the genus of the Black Phoebe, I think, is this right, is Saornis. And so we were thinking of Saornis Farm or Black Phoebe Farm. Anyway, these birds kept like just flitting in and out of our field, and every time we would work out there, there were just Black Phoebes all around, and I just love them. And so, but we just landed back on Crescent Moon Farm.
Well, I always really liked it.
Yeah.
I always really. Yes. So, I know that you're not so much in transition, but you don't necessarily know what the next thing is going to be after mushrooms.
Correct.
I kind of assume you're never going to stop farming because you're so good at it.
Thank you. I hope I don't ever stop.
And it's we like should say that for the last year, or for for the growing season of 2015, you worked with Libby at Beet Generation.
Yes.
So you deserve a rest.
Yeah.
I think all farmers should be resting during January.
Right. Yes.
So how was the season?
It was good. I think things moved pretty efficiently, and we grew. I think we used the space quite well.
And it's on south. It's in South Sebastopol.
It's south 116 south. It's off of Sparks Road. It's on a really beautiful piece of property, like 22, 25 acres or so, right south of Sebastopol. Just it's still in Sebastopol, but just south of town.
Yeah.
And really beautiful property. And she's really fortunate to have landed that spot. It's gorgeous, seemingly plenty of water. And the farm owners or the landowners are really supportive of the business. In fact, they started a pasta. You probably remember the fresh pasta that she was making. She got her home kitchen certified as a cottage industry something or other kitchen. And so she was using produce from the Beach Generation Farm in the fresh pasta.
Right.
Different, like, ancho peppers and serrano peppers and just experimenting.
Poblano serrano pasta. I still have some at home.
And roasted garlic and beet and spinach and, like, really just fun, creative, fun stuff. So, and that's the landowner that's doing that in conjunction with Libby. So it's really great. She's in a great situation, great spot, great people around her.
And she's doing chickens, too, now.
And she's doing, well, so laying hens, I think for more personal use and family. And then the chicken, the meat birds, again, for personal use, family, landlords. Yeah, they're not doing anything commercial with that. It's just sort of for the for themselves and just, on a small scale.
Yeah.
It's still 25 birds at a time, but it's still, but then you can freeze them, you know. And,
sure.
Yeah. And she has friends. You know, I got two birds. I still have one, actually, I need to eat. But
oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my puppies got some of the chicken feet.
Yes, they did.
And I have to say, these were the biggest chicken feet I have ever seen in my life. Yeah. They looked like chickens on steroids. I mean,
but they
looked bigger than turkey feet. I mean, they were huge.
I think they're called Freedom Flyers or Freedom Range.
Freedom. Yeah, there's the Freedom. It's a bird from France.
Okay. Okay. Right. Which makes sense with the whole, like, Freedom Fries thing. Like, years ago.
I know. I think
Freedom Layers. I don't
Pepper know. Road Farms or whatever. Okay. It's Pepper Road Poultry, maybe. They also grow. They raise two kinds of chickens, and that's one
and
of
that's
them.
One of them. Okay.
Yeah, they do the French bird, and I think they're taller.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they're taller
with big
and
feet.
Thinner, and so they would have the longer legs.
Yeah.
And if they're going to have longer legs, they have to have the bigger feet to support that different structure.
And the nice thing about these birds, too, is so I'd been around a few meat birds back in Maine when I, you know, friends of mine raised meat birds, but they were like this big, clunky, stupid, like they don't walk.
Oh, it's so sad.
It's sad.
I can't think of the name right now, but I will. It starts with a C.
Yeah,
and they grow really fast, and they can't walk. It's awful.
And they're just dumb as doorknobs.
Yeah, and they're top heavy. Their breasts are, they've raised for such big breasts that they fall over.
Right. And I remember my friend, so they're having a heat wave in Maine, which in Maine is like, you know, 85 degrees. No, I'm just kidding. It was hot. It was up in the upper 90s, maybe lower 100s. And these birds, several of her birds died because they did not get up and get out of the sun.
Yeah.
And she provided shade, and she was in there like trying to move them. And I mean, it was just, oh my, I couldn't believe it. Anyway, so when I heard Libby was raising meat birds, I was like, oh God, I hope they're not these stupid.
Yeah.
Like, because it just feels horrible to even eat them.
Is it Cochin Cross? It might be Cochin Cross. It's something along those lines.
Cornish Cross?
It might be Cornish Cross. But it's the one that, I mean, if you're buying commodity chicken,
that's
the breed that you're getting.
Right.
And they don't have good lives.
Right. And a friend of mine said she won't eat chicken anymore because she doesn't want to eat any animals that are more stupid than she is. But anyway, but these birds that Libby got were great. They were active and they were out and about. And, you know, it was like, oh, okay. I mean, everybody has opinions about eating birds, but it was like, I don't know. It was just different. It's like, right, I can, you know, you have a good life. You're not bred to be top heavy and dumb and stupid.
Exactly. I don't want to eat things that have had a bad life.
Yeah, no, not at all.
It's a jumbo Cornish cross.
Cornish cross. Okay. Yeah.
There you go. It's crossed with, looks like a rock, probably a Rhode Island red or rock Island. I don't know. Jumbo Cornish cross rocks.
Okay.
There you go.
Thank you, Mike.
Sure.
And on that note, how about another musical break?
We're not quite ready.
Okay, but he'll get ready. We should say right now, because I don't know if we've said which market you're at.
Oh,
you're at Sebastopol
on Sundays.
Mm-hmm. And now you're every week?
Every week, yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Great.
It is good. It's a good place to be. It's such an amazing market.
I love that market. I missed it today. I'm really sorry, but sometimes you just need to curl up in bed for
a
day.
That is true. That is true.
And
okay,
it looks
and
like
we
have music.
Thank you. everybody look who's going down. Hey. Speaking their minds, getting so much resistance from behind. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody looks going down. Hey, carrying signs, Moses saying hooray for our side. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody looks going down. Hey, step out of line, they come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody looks going down. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody looks going down. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody looks going.
It is Mouthful here on KRCB. My guest, Jill Adams. Want to interrupt what we're talking about just for a minute and tell you something that you should be concerned about if you live in Sonoma County, and pay attention because it's not a done deal yet. And a lot of people think it is a done deal. And a lot of us, myself included, often think that anything that we want to contribute to the public dialogue doesn't matter anyway. They're coming to the end of making a decision about what's going to happen with the reunification of Courthouse Square. And they've said the trees will all come out. And apparently that's not true. They are still looking for feedback from the public. What I hear, the main reason for wanting to take the trees out is that the police have wanted it because they want a clear line of sight. So that, I don't know, a teenager smoking a joint or I don't know what. So somebody's not hiding behind a tree. The police have asked for a clear line of sight, no trees. And if you've listened to Mouthful for very long, you know I love the commons, the town square. If you go to Europe, so much of life takes place. You go to the town square and it's ringed with restaurants and coffee shops and people sitting outside watching the parade of life go by. And also participating in it. It's wonderful. And that's one of the things I always really miss when I come home. And we've been building cities that no longer have them. We're in one right now as we broadcast. So Santa Rosa has a really great chance. They want to reunify the square. They don't have to take out the trees. They could do a nice bronze plaque commemorating a time when we were the Redwood Empire. Install that plaque maybe near the redwood trees. They could leave the water so that the fountain so that we have the sound of water. If you haven't thought about any of this, if you haven't taken a look, go take a walk through the town square, Courthouse Square, and, you know, just weigh in with what you think. They've thought about safety. They've thought about traffic. They've talked to the banks. The banks want there to be lots of parking surrounding the town square so that people can just get out of the car and go into the bank. The one thing that they haven't really taken into consideration yet is aesthetics. What will be the pleasure that draws people in? And I'm so hoping that we turn it into a real town square, keep the trees. We need natural shade. We need those lungs of the planet. Anyway, you can write it out. You can go to the city's website. They're taking comments by email. You can give them a phone call. Everything is online these days. So there you go. I say we save those redwood trees in the town square. I say we save redwood trees everywhere, but there you go. My little rant for the evening.
I love it.
So where did your passion for farming come from?
It's rooted in a desire for conservation, really. I was doing wildlife biology work and, you know, bouncing around to New Mexico, Arizona, Southern California, working on different threatened and endangered species projects. And none of those, except for the California Condor Project, none of them felt like we were actually doing any good. It was more like, you know, the Army is wanting to expand their whatever operations on the base, and so they're probably going to relocate these desert tortoise. So why don't you guys figure out, you know, how many there are, where there are, da 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 da. Or, you know, the Air Force wants to do low-flying maneuvers through, you know, steep canyons, and so the spotted owls might be adversely affected. So go in, figure it out. You know, we're going to do it anyway, but let's just see what happens.
Happy work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I loved the work itself. Was really fun and amazing to, you know, get up close and personal.
Oh, sure.
Really amazing animals, but then also just kind of demoralizing. I just didn't feel like I was doing anything of value or anything that I felt like was saving the world, you know. And I was younger and idealistic. And and so through that time, I just, I don't know, started thinking more about food and humans' roles on the planet and learning more about organic food and organic agriculture. And a friend of mine told me about this program called WOOF, Willing Workers on Organic Farms, or Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms is another name. And so a friend of mine and I went to New Zealand and did that for 5 months. And amazing. And it was, New Zealand is amazing already, just amazing on its own. But then just getting back into agriculture, just that introduction to it, and just feel, I don't know, there was something about it that just clicked. It was like, you know how people have, talk about like, oh, what's your calling or what's your vocation?
Sure.
Like, I don't know. but it was in those moments, those first few moments working on farms in New Zealand, it was like, I think this is something. This is something. It just felt very compelling. And it just, and shockingly enough, I remember feeling like the longer I stay in New Zealand, just sort of bumming around the country, the, you know, the more money I'm spending, and the less money, the less time I'll have toward learning about farming and putting toward a farm someday, maybe. And my dream was to go back to Maine and buy up some family land that we'd lost in the family, and, you know, and just and start that farm up. And so it was really interesting. That was like, I was in this really beautiful, amazing place, but felt this deep desire to like, okay, I found what I need to be doing and I need to get back and start on it. Yeah, it was really pretty amazing. And then, so within the year, then I found that internship in Sebastopol.
Is that what brought you to Sonoma County?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you found it through WOOF?
Through WOOF, yeah.
Now, what happened to that farm?
He, like so many small farmers, tire out, or just burn out.
Yeah.
It's so sad. Such a sad story. So he burned out after 5 years, 6 years. I burned out after 5 years, 6 years. I mean, it's a combination of burning out and other circumstances.
Sure.
So in my circumstance, the land was going to get sold. And so, yes, I could have stayed and made things work and kept Crescent Moon Farm, but a lot of other reasons I didn't. Same thing with Neil, I think. Although I think for him, he actually did. The land wasn't getting sold yet. It has now gotten sold and is now vineyard, sadly. But yeah, I think he did sort of just get tired from it. Just it's very intense work.
Yeah,
you know?
It is. It's really hard work.
It is. It's really hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But so satisfying in a lot of ways.
Do you think you'll revive Crescent Moon?
Oh my gosh, I've thought about it. Uh-huh. I don't know. I don't know. In a lot of ways I want to, but same thing. I mean, I don't own land here. I don't know that I'll ever be able to own land here in Sonoma County or California at all. And you put a lot of time and effort and life into building that soil, and
you don't get the equity out of it.
You don't get any equity out of it. And I don't, you know, it'll never be mine. You know, I'll always have that risk of it being sold or, you know, me getting booted or, and it's just, I don't know if I want to do that again. But then part of me is like, well, why not? I mean,
why
that's, what else are you going to do? Uh-huh. It's like, well, I don't know. Mm-hmm. What else? I mean, that's what I'm supposed to be doing with this life. Mm-hmm. With this life, I feel like that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And so I'm sort of grappling with that right now.
Yeah, and
like,
you're really good at it.
Thank you.
You're really, really good at it.
Thank you.
I mean, there are people that grow things that don't taste good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know what that is. I think there's a bit of magic. Mm. And right now I'm rereading Luther Burbank's biography.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, and he had, for lack of a better way to put it, he had that magic touch, you know, and he, in whatever way, he communicated with his plants.
Yeah.
And he coaxed a lot of really miraculous things out of them.
Yeah.
And I always think back to you and that red okra.
Mm.
Where did that even come? I'd never heard of red okra.
Well, you know, do you ever get seed catalogs mailed to you?
I do sometimes, okay. But I probably not paid attention to okra.
Oh, man. It's amazing to look through. Like, I think I first saw it from Seed Savers Exchange, possibly.
Oh, okay,
they're a company out of Iowa, really, and they have such an amazing diversity of different products. And then ultimately, I think I bought those seeds from Southern Exposure Seed Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a lot of different kind of like black-eyed peas, different kinds of beans, Crowder beans, or lots of different unique Southern. And where I was growing in Santa Rosa, it was really hot, and so yes, still with cold nights. It was in Rincon Valley.
Okay.
And we had some pretty, I mean, definitely a huge difference between where Libby is farming now, where I farmed with her this summer, Beach Generation, and then in Rincon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried growing, we did grow the okra, we planted it, but oh my God, I don't know that I ever harvested more than a pound each time
really.
I picked. It was so sad and pathetic. It was heartbreaking. I think a number of factors went into that, but I think a big part of it was just not enough heat.
Not enough heat, yeah.
Yeah, but so yeah, it was really fun. We could kind of grow some really nice hot climate crops out there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so you paw through seed catalogs this time of year, and it's
I do get seed catalogs, and I always get stuck in the flowers.
Oh yeah.
I always get stuck in the calla lily, mainly the calla lilies, the anemones, and then I start fantasizing that I'm going to do a blue garden in one place and a black garden in another, and then it's like, okay, I have to stop.
And then put it away.
Yeah, I get, I've actually had some success with where I live with growing flowers, with growing perennials and flowers. I do better with that.
Great.
I think the footprint of my property is such that doesn't get sun in certain areas until late in the day, or I mean 11 or 1 in some instances, or 3. And then once the sun does get around to the side where my western deck is, it beats down with such hot intensity that I just think I don't have a good footprint.
Right.
And I actually did try growing tomatoes this year. And I thought I'd done it. And they were going to be ripe the next day. And I went out and they were all gone.
The deer, or
I thought it was the deer, but because there are a lot of deer at my house, but the leaves were gone, which I thought was really weird because deer don't eat tomato leaves. I didn't know anything ate tomato leaves. It turns out my new next door neighbor has a rabbit.
And
that little rabbit.
Wow, I'm surprised.
The little rabbit ate all the tomatoes and all the tomato leaves and chewed one. I have a big fern. I have two big ferns. And I think it had to have been the rabbit who ate all of the fern. I think she left enough for it to come back. It
must be a fat rabbit.
It's a pretty big rabbit, but you know. It's like if I grew rabbit food, that's okay. It's just fun to watch.
Yeah. Sweet. Oh, fun.
Okay, so what's next in the next few months? What, you're going to be at the farmer's market?
Yeah, I'll be at the farmer's market.
And you might be working with some seedlings at some point.
Yeah.
And then we can't really talk about that yet, but that's on the horizon as a potential thing.
Potential. And then, I don't know. Yeah, the summer is sort of shapeless right now.
Yeah.
There's... always lots of ideas floating around my head, but mm-hmm. Who knows what'll.
What I want you to do is find a really great patch of land and grow watermelon.
Oh, yeah.
Yellow watermelon, yellow and orange watermelon. I think it's called Sunshine. For several reasons, there's a man, Larry Fields. He's still around. He grew the best watermelon I've ever tasted in my life. And he was growing on the western flank of Sonoma Mountain, mm-hmm. fairly low in Penn Grove. And he was a staple at farmers markets. It was like, I think you guys overlapped a little bit, but by the time of Crescent Moon, he was already winding down as far as farmers markets went. Yeah. And haven't seen him in a year or so to ask him what he's doing now. But two things happened. Got a virus that affected only watermelon plants.
Wow.
So he had to cut way back, and he started growing a lot of muskmelons and a lot of winter squash. Mm. And the winter squash was doing really well. The muskmelon would grow really well, and he had just a very small patch. And I would get a call once a year.
He'd
say, Michelle, you can meet me at the corner of Washington and, Murphy.
Wow, like a drug deal.
And, exactly. And he would fill my trunk with like 7 or 8 yellow watermelon, and I would eat nothing but yellow watermelon for a week, and then that would be all I had.
Wow.
And then the other people, so anyway, he got sick, but he survived cancer. And he's just, he had too many problems with that area. Oh, and the other thing that happened with him is he knew exactly when to pick watermelons. Yeah. And so did the raccoons.
Oh, well, sure.
The raccoons would get them the night before he was going to pick for the market.
Of course.
And they'd eat the underside. So and then the other people who were doing really great watermelons were Ariel and Jeff
mm-hmm.
and they've been on Mouthful a couple times from Redwood Empire Farm, and they've moved away. They were doing fabulous yellow watermelons. Not quite as good as Larry's, but absolutely right up there.
Fantastic.
So there's an idea.
Yeah, there's a hole, I guess. And
there's a hole right now for good watermelon.
I will keep that in mind.
And I think we also had a few cool summers, and I hate to complain about that because I like cool summers.
Yeah.
And they need a lot of heat.
Sure. Yeah.
They need a lot.
And they're just tricky. I feel like I did really well with muskmelons, cantaloupes, mm-hmm. And determining.
And you did some
ready.
Little. Did you do some little green melons?
Haugen. There was an Israeli heirloom.
Haugen. It was really good. Yeah. I remember that melon of yours.
Spicy.
That was really good.
Yeah, really nice. A
lot of people are not growing green melons right now.
No, huh?
They told me, everybody wants the orange melons, and I'm looking for even orange honeydews, and I'm trying to find green flesh melons because I love them. And a lot of people have quit because they can't sell them, which I think is really weird.
Y'all
listen to me. Eat your green melons. They're delicious.
But on Crescent Moon Farm, we grew a variety called Arava, and it was a Gallia style.
Yeah.
And it was delicious. It's one of the best melons
I used to get that melon from you. It was really, really good.
Nice. Yeah. But so I feel confident with melons. Watermelons, tricky. I thought I had it down. Like the summer we grew on Beet Generation, and I thought I had it down, and we, we get feedback from customers. It's like, no, that was really underripe. That was bad. It's like, but all the signs were there and it sounded right. And all the thumps and the leaf at the axle of the stem and blah, 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 and then nope, failed.
In
so
the end, nature,
right.
In the end,
right.
We're just shepherding it
That's
along.
Right. That's right.
So see, and we're almost out of time.
Oh my goodness.
See, it goes fast.
It did go fast.
So a couple things I want to preview because we've been off the air for 3 weeks. I want to preview what's coming up. Next week, we're going to talk to someone, first name Brooks. Can't remember the last name. Someone who is newly arrived in Sonoma County in Sebastopol, who is going to talk about making your kitchen more manageable. It's somebody who, one of these people who is consulting on how to get the junk out of your life, you could say, and has an interesting story about going and helping a woman clean out her garage, but ending up spending all of the time in the kitchen instead. So, January is a good time for stuff like that. And then the following Sunday, we have the gentleman from the East Coast, the Atlantic Seaboard Wineries, is that it? Atlantic Seaboard Wine Association.
Yeah.
They will be here on the last Sunday of the month, coming out again. And then, if everything goes as planned, MFK Fisher wrote a novel in the late 1930s. And for many decades, it sat in a red box in Robert Lesher's office. Robert Lesher was her agent for a very long time. At the time she wrote it, it was thought that it wasn't appropriate to publish at the time, a little too racy. And he died a couple of years ago, and the book is now coming out. There's going to be an event at the Bouverie Preserve on February 13th, and I'm working on getting somebody from the publisher and maybe somebody who worked on the book on February 6th to talk about that. So that's pretty exciting. Something new from MFK Fisher. It sounds like it's thinly veiled autobiography. Two couples bumming around Europe in 1938 as, you know, fascism was drawing that dark blanket over Europe, and two couples in love were dealing with it. So that's on February 6th.
So let me jump in. It's the Atlantic Seaboard Wine Association.
Okay. And we will, this time I'm leaving it up to them. We have had, I think this will be, well, we didn't have them last year. We skipped
you were
a year.
You were taking your book break.
Yes, I was taking my books break. And I think the last time they were here, which would be 2 years ago, we tasted champagnes, sparkling wines.
And they had, I think it was, they had some champagnes and a lot of, it was all whites.
Right. And this year I've told them whatever they want. We've been through every category, and so now they get to decide what we're going to be enjoying with those fine gentlemen brought here by Ann Vercelli. And on that note, Jill Adams, thank you.
Thank you so much. OysterCreekMushroom.com.
Yes, thank you for letting me rope you in.
My pleasure.
I appreciate that. Thanks, as always, to Mouthful's engineer, Mike Young. And thanks to you for listening. Meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of Mouthful Smart Talk about food, wine, and farming.